Perhaps they would bring up the famed Russian artillery and help the Germans pulverize the Polish capital twice as fast. This news seemed to him the authentic end of the world, and he was not aware of laughing. He peered at the paper, swimming before his eyes. "I understand the situation is extraordinary," he managed to say, surprising himself with his own reasonable glibness. "But a communication from the head of a municipality to a head of government is awkward. An approach from President Moshchitsky or Marshal Smigelritz, somebody in the national government, might prove more fruitful."
"But, sir, our national government has crossed the border into Romania. They are probably under house arrest by now, and the Germans will have them by the neck before the week is out. There's only Warsaw. But we are unafraid, and we are fighting on. We want to know what we can hope for."
Sloat got hold of himself and scanned the dispatch. Familiar, pathetic rhetoric of appeal, like all the messages from Radio Warsaw to France and England during the past weeks. In fact, the mayor was talking very much in his broadcasting style. "I'm not sure how fast I can get this out, sir. Lately I've been encountering 12-hour delays, and more, via Stockholm.
I guarantee you immediate transmission. You can send this in plain language. Let the whole world know,"
the mayor shouted, waving a fist,
"that the people of Warsaw are fighting on despite the Russian treachery, and that we are calling on the great American president for a word of hope. If he speaks, the Allies will listen. They'll march before it's too late. The Germans can still be smashed from behind. All their power is in Poland. The Allies can roar to Berlin in 2 weeks. Let the president only speak, and they will march."
"We can encode it very rapidly, Your Honor. I think that's more prudent. We'll be ready to transmit in half an hour." In a more businesslike tone, Starzynski said, "Call my office and we will arrange direct voice communication for you with Stockholm or Bern." He stood up and glanced around the room. "A peaceful oasis. The Luftwaffe respects the American flag. Very wise of them. How soundly the boy sleeps." "He's exhausted, Mr. Mayor. How about the evacuation of neutrals? Did you discuss that with the Germans yesterday?"
"It was not the moment. They came under a flag of truce to ask for our surrender. General Joma wouldn't accept the message. The German officers wouldn't discuss any other subject. They said they would reduce us to rubble."
The mayor's voice rose to broadcasting pitch.
"They're dropping leaflets all over the city this morning with the same threat. But where are the swarms of airplanes and the hurricanes of shells they talk about? The Germans are already throwing at us everything they've got. They have nothing to add but words. They've been doing their worst for 2 weeks, and here we are still. Let President Roosevelt only speak out, and civilization can still see a historic victory on the Vistula."
His voice dropped. The exalted glow left his face.
"I did mention the problem of the neutrals. Their emissary indicated that something would be worked out soon."
The mayor gave Sloat a cool look and added, with a smile that twisted his mustache,
"We don't expect you to stay on and share our fate."
"You understand that we have 19 women here," Sloat said, feeling under the weight of this smile a need to apologize.
"Men, women, what's the difference? You're neutral."
The mayor held out his hand.
"Please send the message. I must broadcast it eventually. I want to give your great president the courtesy of a period for private consideration of his reply."
Sloat grasped his hand. "We Americans here are awed by the stand of Warsaw. Of that I can assure you. We will never forget it. And when we get home, we will tell the story." The mayor seemed moved.
Yes, the Germans are not supermen, you see. Warsaw has already taught that to the world. Some Germans are personally fine people, but as a nation they are swine. It is a matter of deep national immaturity and feelings of inferiority. A very complex question. They have the machines, the railroads, the factories. But we are not afraid of them. All we ask is a chance to keep fighting them.
I will certainly convey that to my government.
We need help.
I am going from here to dig a trench. The mayor theatrically showed his blistered palms and left. Sloat scrawled at his desk for several minutes, then summoned a coding clerk.
Byron, wake up!
He shook Byron's shoulder, smearing his hand with brick dust.
Come on, get up. All hell is breaking loose.
Byron turned over and opened dull eyes. The Russians are coming. God knows when they'll be here. They invaded Poland this morning. Go and call Natalie. With an elastic movement, Byron came erect and awake.
The Russians? Holy cow! This thing's getting interesting.
Interesting? Byron, look, Warsaw will probably become the no-man's land between the German and Russian armies. The city can be blown to atoms. Get Natalie and tell her she's to come here and stay here. Working in a belligerent's hospital is damned questionable anyway, and now...
Sloat walked to the door, putting a fist, holding the pipe distractedly, to his head.
What a mess. So much to do.
Byron yawned and rose.
But what's the rush? How far is the Russian border from here?
200 or 300 kilometers? Their army can't possibly get to Warsaw for a week.
Sloat laughed. It had not occurred to him that the Russian armies needed several days to advance 300 kilometers. But it was true, and very obvious.
He took out his pouch and packed the pipe slowly to calm himself, saying,
"Of course, but the point is, this development changes everything. There's never any predicting what the Russians or the Germans will do next. There may be dogfights over Warsaw today. The Germans may decide on half an hour's notice to let the neutrals out of here."
"Well, I'll try to get her, but you know Natalie."
"Please tell Natalie it's not a message from me,"
Sloat said in a tight, ragged tone, his hand on the doorknob, his head pounding.
"But an official notice from the United States government. We can no longer be responsible for the safety of anybody outside the four walls of this building. If we suddenly get packed out of here under a flag of truce, and it can happen any time, and she isn't around, I can't delay 5 minutes. We'll go, and she'll be the only foreigner left in Warsaw. And if by some freak she survives the bombs and the Nazis, she can write a book. Tell her that, will you?"
He closed the door hard. By now, Byron knew the route to the hospital well. It went through a part of town which the Germans had been pounding hard. Sooty heaps of rubble pockmarked the way. There were craters in the streets, broken sewer pipes, torn cable conduits, downed telephone poles, uprooted trees, and endless piles of broken glass, masonry, wood, and rubbish. Children played on the heaps and in the ruined buildings. Women were washing clothes in the open or cooking over pale fires of splintered wood in the bright sunshine. Work gangs were digging in the fallen houses, clearing twisted wires from the street, and shoveling and bulldozing debris. Almost everybody appeared cheerful and matter-of-fact. That was the remarkable thing, though Byron was getting used to it. He passed no funerals or other traces of the dead. Leaping, climbing, laughing in the destroyed houses, the children seemed to be finding war an amusing novelty. And school was evidently out. Here and there, black-shawled women sat with bowed heads on chairs or stones, some bared breasts to sucking babies. Many people with blank faces wandered amid the rubble and stared or fumbled to find things.
No fires were burning. The destruction was capricious. One block would be undamaged, the next half-razed, as though an airplane had dumped all its bombs at once. Over jagged, slanting half-walls, rooms like stage settings hung in the air, their different wallpapers or paint colorfully and pathetically exposed. Byron saw a broken piano hanging half out of one room. He made his way through the entrance hall of the hospital. Here, Warsaw's surprisingly cheerful air gave way to a pitiful and disgusting scene. Wounded people were piled and crowded helter-skelter along the marble floor awaiting help. Mostly in rags, all dirty, green-pale, groaning or crying or in a faint. Men and women, Poles and Jews, blood-smeared, unbandaged, with clothing ripped, with faces torn open, with arms and legs gashed, with an occasional red stump of limb blown away, and terrible white bone showing. The children were piled separately in a big anteroom, where a sad chorus of wailing and screaming rose, mingled with some incongruous laughter. Byron hurried past the open door and down the curving stone staircase, into a long, low basement area much warmer than the floor above. Here, the stink of faultily burning oil stoves was even stronger than the smells of medicine.
"Is he crazy?" Natalie exclaimed. "How can I leave? I just came on duty. Look!"
She swept her arm around at the women in the jammed-together beds, moaning and shrieking in Polish, at others sitting up dolefully on beds or low stools, with fat white breasts and brown nipples bared to infants, at the three pallid sweating doctors moving from bed to bed, at the hastening nurses, some in soiled, blood-stained white dresses like herself, with hair bound in white cloths, some in dark gray nuns' habits.
"There are five of us down here, and we counted 82 women this morning. It's the only maternity ward left in Warsaw now. The Germans bombed out St. Catherine's last night. They say it was unspeakably horrible. Pregnant women running around on fire, newborn babies burning up."
"The point is, Natalie, with the Russians coming—"
"I heard you. They're hundreds of miles away, aren't they? Go away, Briny. I have to work."
A stoop-shouldered doctor with a big nose, a square red beard, and sad, filmed eyes was walking past. He asked Natalie in German what the problem was, and she told him.
"Go, by all means go," he said in an exhausted voice. "Don't be foolish. You must leave with the other Americans. If the embassy sends for you, you must obey."
"Oh, the embassy. Nobody says we're leaving yet. This young man can come and fetch me in 5 minutes if they do."
"No, no, that's a risk you can't take. You're not a Pole. You're not supposed to risk your life. And you're Jewish. You're Jewish."
The doctor put his hand to her head and pulled off the white cloth. Her loose hair fell, thick, curling, dark.
"You must go home."
Tears ran out of Natalie's eyes and down her face.
"The woman with the twins is hemorrhaging. Did you see her yet? And the baby with the bad foot?"
She gestured jerkily at a bed nearby.
"They're all on the list. Go back to the embassy right away."
"Thank you. You've helped us. Have a safe journey."
The doctor shuffled away. She turned on Byron.
"Leslie Sloat is a selfish bastard. He just doesn't want to have me on his mind. One thing less to think about."
Suddenly she raised her skirt to her hips. The gesture gave Byron a shocking little thrill, though in point of fact the heavy gray bloomers coming down to her knees were considerably less sexy than the white skirt. She must have gotten those gruesome bloomers from the nuns, he thought.
"Here," she said, pulling a thick wallet from her bloomers and dropping the skirt. I'll go back to the goddamn embassy, but just in case, I want you to go and find Beryl and give him this. It's all my American money. Will you do that for me?
Sure.
Tell me, Briny, Natalie said, are you still having fun? He looked around at the noisy, crowded, evil-smelling ward, where the Polish women were helplessly bringing new life into a city which was being dynamited to death by the Germans. Going through unpostponable birth pangs with the best care the dying city could give them. More fun than a barrel of monkeys. Be careful going back to the embassy, will you? There's a big burning church on Franciszki, and they've got the street blocked off. Go around by the museum. All right. You'll probably find Beryl in that gray building, you know, where the Jewish Council works. He's on the food committee or something. I guess I'll find him. Byron came out in a back alley where two men were loading dead people from the hospital onto a two-wheeled cart, much like the one he had bought to carry the water. Bodies lay on the cobblestones, and one man, wearing a red-smeared white oilcloth apron, was taking them up one by one in his arms and thrusting them at the other man, who stacked them in the cart. Large, rigid horrors with open mouths and fixed eyes, like dead fish in a market. The man tossed up the light body of a scrawny old woman, whose gray pubic hair showed through the pink rag, still hanging on her. Hurrying down Marshal Pilsudski Boulevard toward the Jewish section, he heard the thumping of heavy guns and nearby explosions, like the blasting at a building site. Byron muttered routine curses at the Germans. He had spent a week in Germany after defecting from the University of Florence. They had seemed odd, but no more so than the Italians. Foreigners, but human enough, with a boisterous sense of fun and very polite manners. Yet here they were, surrounding the Polish capital, pounding it with explosives and flying steel, breaking the water mains, killing the children, turning living people into stiff, glassy-eyed, dead, stacked garbage to be carted away and disposed of. It was really the most amazing outrage. To call it war was not to make it any more understandable. This peculiar and horrible state of affairs in which he accidentally found himself was nevertheless far more colorful and interesting than peace, as Byron remembered it. Delivering water to the United States Embassy was the most satisfying thing he had done in his life. He loved the job. He was willing to be killed doing it, but the odds were all with him. This was the novel thing he was finding out. Most of the people in Warsaw were still alive and unhurt and going about their business. The city was far from destroyed or even half destroyed. As he made his way to Naryskaya district, he passed through many a block of brown three-story houses, which stood undamaged, peaceful and quiet, looking exactly as they had before the German attack. But in the Jewish quarter itself, there were no such undamaged blocks. It was one broad, smoky ruin. Clearly the Germans were raining extra shells and bombs on this district. A pointless course, since the Jews of Warsaw could not compel the surrender of the city. Such a deluge of fire and explosion concentrated on the city's vitals, power, water, transport, bridges, instead of on the Jews, could break Warsaw much faster. The bombardment of the Naryskaya was an irrational, wasteful assault by a powerful army against sad, unarmed paupers. The Juden Verboten signs Byron had seen on park benches in Germany had been too bizarre to seem real. This bombardment of the Naryskaya district first drove home to him the queer fact that the Germans really had murder in their hearts for these people. Trolley cars lay on their sides, burned out.
Swollen dead horses stank in the streets, in clouds of fat black flies that sometimes settled thickly on Byron's hands and face. There were dead cats and dogs, too, and a lot of dead rats scattered in the gutter. He saw only one human body, an old man crumbled in a doorway. He had noticed before how quick the Jews were to remove their dead, and how they treated the corpses with respect, covering the loaded carts with cloths, and following them in silent, mournful straggles through the streets. But despite the smashing up of the houses, the continuing fires, the smoke, the rubble, this quarter still abounded in eager, crowded life. On one corner, outside a ruined schoolhouse, boys in skullcaps sat with their bearded teacher on the sidewalk, chanting over enormous books. Some of the boys were not much larger than the books. Kiosks were still festooned with dozens of different newspapers and journals printed in heavy Hebrew lettering. He heard someone in a house practicing on a violin. The vendors of wilted vegetables and spotted stunted fruit, of tinned food and old clothes, stood along the sidewalks or pushed their creaky handcarts amid crowds of people. Work gangs were clearing rubble from bombed houses off the streets and the sidewalks. There were plenty of hands for the work. Byron wondered at this, for in the past weeks, Jewish men and boys, perhaps because they were so recognizable, had seemed to erupt all over Warsaw, digging trenches, fighting fires, repairing mains. One bent old graybeard in skullcap and caftan, wielding a shovel in a trench, gave a Jewish look to a whole workforce. Nevertheless, they did appear to be pitching in everywhere. Beryl Jastrow was not in the council building. Wandering through crowded, dark, dingy corridors lit only by flickering thick candles, Byron chanced on a man whom he had once seen conferring with Beryl, a little, neat, bearded Jew with a glass eye that gave him a wall-eyed stare. Talking a mishmash of German and Yiddish, the man conveyed that Beryl was inspecting the community kitchens. Byron set out to hunt him down, and came on him in a huge Romanesque synagogue of gray stone. Undamaged, except for a broken stone Star of David in a round, glassless window. Jastrow stood in a low, hot anteroom where people were lined up for a strong-smelling stew ladled out by kerchiefed, perspiring women from tubs on wood-burning stoves.
"The Russians," Beryl stroked his beard. "This is definite."
"Your mayor came to the embassy with the news."
"Let us go outside."
They talked out in the street, well away from the food queue. The raggedly dressed people in line stared at them and tried to hear the conversation, even cupping hands to ears.
"I must report this to the Central Committee," Beryl said.
"It may be good news, who knows? Suppose the two robbers cut each other's throats, hm? Such things have happened. The Russians could be messengers of God."
He was taken aback when Byron offered him Natalie's wallet.
"But what is she thinking?" he said. "I have money. I have dollars. She may need that herself. She isn't out of Warsaw yet."
Byron was embarrassed. It had not occurred to him that Jastrow might be offended, but now the reaction seemed natural. He said the Americans expected to leave Warsaw soon, under a flag of truce.
"So, we won't see you or Natalie again?"
"Possibly not."
"Ah, well, if the Germans let all you Americans out together, she should be safe. She told me an American passport says nothing about religion. Tell her I thank her, and I'll put the money in the food fund. Tell her, Vorsicht."
A shell whistled down and exploded some distance away, making Byron's ears ache. Beryl spoke hurriedly.
So they are coming back to this neighborhood again. They shell by a system, the Germans. Yesterday was Yom Kippur, and all day the shells fell on us. They never stopped. Now, will you be seeing Arella?
He smiled wryly at Byron's blank look.
Dr. Aaron Jastrow, he said, mimicking English pronunciation.
I guess so.
Tell him, Beryl said, Lech Lecha. Can you remember that? It's two simple Hebrew words, Lech Lecha.
Lech Lecha, Byron said.
Very good. You're a fine Hebrew student.
What does it mean?
Get out.
Beryl gave a worn white card to Byron.
Now, will you do me a favor? This is a man in New Jersey, an importer. He sent a bank draft in August for a large shipment of mushrooms. It came too late. I destroyed the draft, so there's no problem, but what are you smiling at?
Well, you have so much to worry about, and yet you think of this?
Jastrow shrugged. This is my business. The Germans, they'll either come in or they won't. After all, they're not lions and tigers, they're people. They'll take our money, it'll be a very bad time, but a war always ends.
Listen, if the Russians come, they'll take our money too, so...
He held out his hand to Byron.
So, God bless you. And...
Byron heard the noise of a shell very close, the unmistakable sloppy whirr and whistle. It went splintering through the synagogue roof. The stunning explosion came a second or two later, giving him a chance to clap his hands to his ears and fall to the ground. Strangely, it did not blow out the front wall, and this is what saved the people on the line. Fragments of the roof went flying through the air, raining in a clatter on the street and on nearby buildings. Then, even as he and Jastrow stood, they saw the whole facade of the synagogue come sliding down like a descending curtain, disintegrating as it went with a rumble and gathering crash. By now, the queue of people had run out of danger. White dust boiled up, and through this cloud, which the breeze thinned at once, Byron could see the marble pillars and carved wooden doors of the Holy Ark untouched on the far wall, looking naked and out of place in the pale, smoky sunshine. Beryl slapped him sharply on the shoulder.
Go, go, don't stay here. Go now. I have to help.
Jewish men and boys were already groping into the new ruin, where many little fires were flickering. Little as he knew of Judaism, Brian understood that they meant to save the scrolls.
All right, I'm going back to Natalie.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. A safe journey to both of you.
Byron left at a trot. The uncovering of the Holy Ark to the sunshine had shocked him like a piece of powerful music. Jogging back through the Jewish quarter of Warsaw, he saw these smashed rows of gray and brown houses, these cobbled streets and dirt alleys, these shabby courtyards and mews hung with drying laundry, these crowds of orderly Jews in beards and broad hats, these dark-eyed, cheerful children playing under the bombs, these dogged, tired street vendors with their carts and baskets, these kiosks laden with newspapers, magazines, feuilletons, and paper-bound books, this smoke-filtered sunshine, these overturned trolleys, these dead horses. He saw all this in super-bright detail, each picture printing itself on his mind as though he were a painter. Without surprise or fear, he noticed thick V's of German planes coming out of the north. The sight had grown ordinary. He continued to trot, a little faster, through the emptying, shell-pitted streets toward the embassy. People around him glanced at the sky and took shelter. The first waves were Stukas, diving down and spitting out black smoke, and Byron heard the irritated answering rattle of the weak rooftop machine guns of the Poles. One plane dove toward the street where he was running. He jumped into a doorway. Bullets went chattering down along the cobblestones with a great wing-wang of ricochets. He watched the plane zoom away, then he trotted on, muttering the usual obscenities about the Germans. Byron was developing a sense of invulnerability to the worst the Germans could do. To him, they were contemptible, bungling butchers. He was sure that the United States was going to rise in its wrath in short order, cross the Atlantic, and knock the hell out of them, if the British and the French really proved too decayed or too scared to do it. The events around him must be making gigantic headlines in America, he thought. He would have been stupefied to know that the Polish War, its outcome clear, was already slipping to the back pages of United States papers, and that people were ignoring even the supposed great debate in the Senate over revising the Neutrality Act because of the tight National League pennant race. He loped through the embassy gate very much out of breath. The Marine sentry gave him a salute and a familiar grin. Inside, in the big dining room, darkened by window braces and blackout curtains, some 50 or so Americans caught in Warsaw were lunching at long trestle tables lit by oil lamps, making a loud clatter. Sloat sat with Natalie, a small dark man named Mark Hartley, and some others at the ambassador's polished dining table. Panting from the long run, Byron told Natalie about his meeting with Beryl. He did not mention the destroyed synagogue.
"Thanks, Briny. God help them all. Sit down and eat something. We have marvelous breaded veal cutlets, by some miracle."
Sloat said, "Did you come here through the streets during this air attack?"
"He has duck feathers for brains," Natalie said, giving Byron an affectionate look.
"Byron is all right," Hartley said. He was a fourth at bridge with Natalie, Byron, and Sloat when they whiled away long night hours in the cellar. Mark Hartley's name had once been Marvin Horowitz, and he liked to joke about the change. He was a New Yorker in the importing business. Byron took an empty seat beside Natalie and helped himself to a cutlet. It had a rather gamey, sticky taste, but after a week of canned sprats and sausages it seemed delicious, and he was famished. He downed it and forked another onto his plate. Sloat smiled at him and glanced around with satisfaction at the Americans happily consuming the cutlets. "By the way, does anybody here object to eating horse meat?"
"I most certainly do," said Natalie.
"Well, that's too bad. You've just eaten it."
Natalie said, "Ah!" and choked into her napkin. "My God, horse! I could kill you. Why didn't you warn me?"
"You need nourishment. We all do. There's no telling what's going to become of us, and I had the chance to buy up this lot, and I did. You've been dining on one of the great breeds of Poland. The mayor ordered the slaughter of 1,000 of them yesterday. We were lucky to get a share."
Mark Hartley took another cutlet from the platter. Natalie said, "Mark, how can you? Horse!"
He shrugged.
"We gotta eat. I've eaten worse meat in kosher restaurants."
"Well, I don't claim to be religious, but I draw the line at horses. I'd as soon eat a dog." Byron pushed away his plate. The awareness of horse flesh heavy in his stomach, the gluey taste of horse in his mouth, the remembered smell of fly-blown dead horses on the Jewish streets blended in his consciousness as one thing. War.
Chapter 14. 4 days later, early in the morning, Natalie came scampering out into the embassy backyard, hair and skirt flying, and pounced on Byron, who was burning passport blanks and visa application files. The embassy had hundreds of the maroon passport booklets, which went up slowly and smokily.
In German hands, they could be used for smuggling spies and saboteurs into the United States. The stacks and stacks of visa requests, because they identified Jews, were also high on the burn list. Byron had given up riffling through the files for the American currency, often clipped to the application forms. His job was to reduce the stuff to ashes as fast as he could. He was burning money and didn't care.
"Hurry, come with me."
Natalie's voice had a cheerful, excited ring. "Where?"
"Just come."
In a chauffeured black limousine at the front gate, Sloat sat next to a plump, pink, gray-headed man. "Hi there, Byron." Sloat, too, sounded surprisingly cheerful. "This is the Swedish ambassador. Byron Henry's father is our naval attaché in Berlin, ambassador. It might be well to take him along, don't you think?" The ambassador rubbed the side of his bulbous nose with a small, neat hand and gave Byron a wise look.
"Very much so. Yes, indeed. And he should perhaps take notes."
"Just what I thought. Hop in, Byron." A blood transfusion could not have changed Sloat more. Byron had talked to him an hour earlier. The familiar, gray, dour, slumped Sloat, who had been glooming around the embassy, taking medicines, snapping short answers, and spending hours locked in his office. Ever since a bomb had fallen on the building next door, killing 10 Poles, Sloat had been like that. Byron figured the responsibility was wearing the chargé down. But now his face had color, his eyes were bright, and the very plume of blue smoke from his pipe looked jaunty. As Byron got into the back seat, Natalie blurted to the ambassador,
"Can I come along? Byron and I are traveling together."
With an annoyed grimace, Sloat shook his head. The ambassador looked her up and down, with masculine amusement. Natalie wore a green silk dress and an old pink sweater, an atrocious get-up pulled from her suitcase without thought. It made her look vulgarly sexy.
"But, my dear, wouldn't you be frightened?"
"Of what?"
"The sound of guns. We're going to inspect the safe conduct exit route."
The ambassador's slow British speech was almost perfect. His small pink hand, resting on the open window, was manicured to a gleam, siege or no siege.
"We may come rather close to the front."
"I've heard guns."
The ambassador smiled at Byron.
"Well, shall we have your friend along?"
He moved to make room for her beside him as he spoke. Sloat said nothing, but gnawed his pipe in an annoyed way. The car started off on a rough zigzag ride toward the river. Warsaw had been crumpling in the past 4 days. A strong wind was blowing away the smoke, and beautiful morning sunshine gave a mocking, peaceful look to the streets. But smashed buildings met the eye everywhere. Thousands of windows had been blown out and patched with bright yellow plywood. Warsaw was becoming a place of smoke, broken masonry, and yellow patches. The sidewalks and gutters were broken and cratered, and spiky tank traps and barricades cluttered main intersections. Glowering, nervous soldiers at these intersections stopped the car with raised machine guns, their fingers at the triggers. Few other people were in sight. Far off, cannon drummed and thumped. Each time that a soldier lowered his gun and waved them on, Sloat laughed boisterously.
"What I find so incredible," he said,
as they came to a long stone bridge over the Vistula, crowded with carts, trucks, and bicycles,
"is that this thing is still standing at all. Haven't the Germans been bombarding it for 2 weeks?"
"Well, you see, they are just not quite as devastating as they would have us believe," the Swedish ambassador said.
"Nor as accurate."
The car drove out on the bridge, over the broad brown river serenely flowing between Warsaw and its eastern suburb, Praga, a place of low houses and green woods. Behind them, in the sunshine, under a soft, smoky blue sky, Warsaw, at this distance, looked surprisingly unharmed. A broad metropolis with wide avenues, Baroque church domes, tall factory chimneys, and many climbing columns of black smoke. It might almost have been a manufacturing city on a busy day in peacetime, except for the yellow fires billowing up here and there, the flashes like summer lightning all around the horizon, and the distant whumping of the artillery. Several busloads of singing and joking soldiers went past the car. Some waved at Natalie and shouted. Many soldiers were also heading the same way on bicycles.
"Where are they all going?"
"Why, to the front," said the ambassador. "It's quite a war. They leave their guns and go home for lunch or dinner.
Or perhaps to sleep with their wives. And then they take a bus to the front again and shoot at the Germans. Madrid was rather like this when I was there during the Civil War."
"How far do we go?" Sloat said. Here over the river, the gun booms from Praha were louder. The ambassador pursed his lips.
"I'm not sure. We have to look for a schoolhouse with a stone goose in the front yard, 100 yards or so past a wayside shrine."
On the other side of the river, they found a scene of ruin. Broken houses, burned tree trunks, and fallen trees lined the narrow, tarred road, which was so torn up by shellfire that the car had to detour time and again on dirt tracks. A camouflaged, heavy Polish gun in the woods suddenly went off as the limousine bumped along one of these paths. The driver swerved and brushed a tree. The passengers leaped in their seats.
"My God!" Sloat said.
The car steadied up and drove on through the wooded flatland of Praha. They passed a house with its roof ablaze, and the family outside, dolefully watching. Loud explosions went off around them, 2 or 3 a minute. Sometimes they saw flames from gun mouths in the woods, though the guns themselves were invisible. Sometimes, through the trees, they could observe Polish gun crews feverishly moving about. It was all novel and exciting, at least to Byron, and they seemed to be enjoying this wartime sightseeing in perfect safety, despite the unpleasant bumping along grass and dirt to avoid the shell holes. But then a German shell burst near the car, throwing up a geyser of dirt which rattled and tinkled on the limousine roof. Sloat said,
"Christ almighty, we're at the front right now."
"Yes, the schoolhouse must be right past that next curve," the ambassador said.
But past the curve they saw only 4 log houses around a dirt courtyard, where several pigs trotted here and there, bewildered by the gun noise. Beyond, the straight tar road continued into leafy woods and smoke, and visibility ceased. Sloat said,
"Please, stop the car."
The ambassador glanced over his shoulder at him, rubbed his nose with a pink hand, and spoke to the driver. The car pulled to the side of the road.
"I didn't in the least understand from you," Sloat said, gesturing with the pipe clutched in a fist, "that we were going into the actual zone of fire. Are you sure that we haven't missed a turn and that we aren't behind the German lines right now?"
The ambassador pushed out his lips.
"I don't believe we've come more than 3 miles from the bridge."
Sloat burst out laughing and jerked the pipe at Natalie and Byron.
"These young people are my responsibility. I can't expose them in this way."
2 loads of soldiers came along in lumbering old street buses with route numbers still displayed in front and faded movie advertisements on their sides. The soldiers were singing, and some waved out of the window at the halted limousine or gave good-humored yells in Polish.
"Clearly we are not yet behind the German lines," said the ambassador.
"Nevertheless, we'll have to take these civilians back to Warsaw," Sloat said. "I'm sorry, you and I misunderstood each other." Natalie exclaimed. But why? There's no reason on earth to take us back. I'm perfectly all right.
I'm afraid there isn't time.
The ambassador deliberately scratched his eyebrow.
The ceasefire will probably come within the hour. As soon as we get back, I'll have to start assembling my party.
So will I. But it's up to the Poles and the Germans, after all, to ensure that the neutrals cross the lines safely. The ambassador glanced at his watch.
Colonel Rakovsky asked that we come out and view the route ahead of time. I really do think we'd better go on.
Two heavy guns went off in the woods.
Vroom, vroom.
One to the left, one to the right. The chauffeur whirred the ignition.
Just a moment.
The driver turned around and looked at Sloat, who'd gone dead pale, his mouth working.
Ambassador, I must insist that you at least take us back to the bridge first. Perhaps there we can hitch a ride on a truck or bus.
But, my dear sir, you should see the route, too. Our parties may get separated later, in the woods.
A peculiar feeling knotted Byron's stomach. The ambassador's faultless manners did not obscure what was happening, and Sloat represented the United States. He said,
Leslie, I think you're dead right about Natalie. Why not take her into one of those log houses and wait? I can go on with the ambassador and get the information, if you like.
The ambassador at once said cheerfully,
Excellent idea. We can go and return in 10 or 15 minutes, I'm sure.
Sloat opened the car door and got out. Come on, Natalie. We'll wait in the one with the green blinds, Ambassador. I saw a woman at the windows.
Natalie stayed in her seat, looking from Sloat to the Ambassador.
Her mouth pulled down unpleasantly. The Ambassador said to her in a stiff European tone,
My dear, please do as you are told.
Jumping out, she slammed the door and ran toward the house. Sloat hurried after her, shouting. The limousine shot forward in the rattle of pebbles. The haze ahead thinned as they drove into it. About half a mile further along, they came upon the shrine, a luridly colored wooden Jesus on a gilt cross in a sheltering frame. And not far beyond that was the schoolhouse. Several soldiers, smoking and talking, lounged in front of it around a stone goose bordered with red flowers. Byron thought that if Leslie Sloat could have held on only 3 or 4 more minutes, he would have been all right. That one bad moment in the limousine, when the dirt hit the roof, had been unlucky for him. Colonel Rakovsky hailed the Swedish ambassador with a shout and a hug. He seemed in unrealistically good spirits, Byron thought, and indeed all the staff officers looked too chipper, considering the bad news that shrieked from the military map of the front on the wall. A crude, thick, red crayon circle, completely ringing Warsaw. On the other walls of the schoolhouse, bright kindergarten pictures hung. Rakovsky, an enormous man with pointed blonde mustaches and a big nose empurpled by good living, led the visitors out a back door and along a leaf-carpeted path to a concrete gun emplacement, where grimy, whiskered men, stripped to the waist, were piling shells. Motioning the visitors to come on up, the colonel climbed the shallow cement slope and mounted the sandbags. Byron followed the ambassador. A forested plain lay before them, dipping toward the east, with a scattering of houses and farms, and 3 widely separated church spires. Puffs of smoke out there, Byron realized, came from German artillery. Panting from the little climb, the ambassador and the officer talked volubly, gesturing at the church spires. The ambassador scrawled notes and translated bits to Byron. On the terms of the ceasefire, he said, the neutral refugees would cross, unescorted, from the Polish to the German lines, heading for the farthest church, where Wehrmacht trucks would meet them.
Colonel Rakovsky feared that some refugees might wander on the poorly marked dirt roads, head for the wrong church, and find themselves between two fires when the truce, for which the Germans were granting only 2 hours, was ended. So he had asked the Swedish ambassador to come out and study the route beforehand. "He says," the ambassador observed to Byron, closing his notebook, "that the best view is from that observation tower. You can make out the different roads all the way to the Kantorovich Church." Byron looked at the spindly wooden tower erected close by in the school's play yard. A narrow ladder led to a square metal-shielded platform where he could see the helmet of a soldier. "Well, I'll go up, okay? Maybe I can make a sketch." "The colonel says the tower has been drawing quite a bit of fire." Byron managed a grin. With a paternal smile, the ambassador handed him the notebook and pen. Byron trotted to the ladder and went up, shaking the frail tower as he climbed. Here was a perfect view of the terrain. He could see all the roads, all the turn-offs of the brown zigzags across no man's land to the far church. The soldier, on watch, glanced away from his binoculars to gawk as the young American, in an open shirt and loose gray sweater, sketched the roads in the ambassador's notebook, struggling with the pages as they flapped in the wind, marking all the wrong turns with X's and crudely picturing the three churches in relation to the route. The soldier nodded when Byron showed him the sketch and slapped his shoulder. "Okay," he said, with a grin of pride at his mastery of Americanese. Natalie leaned in the open doorway of the cottage, arms folded as the limousine drew up. She hurried to the car, followed in a moment by Sloat, who first said goodbye at the door to a kerchiefed old woman in heavy boots. As the car drove back toward Warsaw, the ambassador recounted their visit to the front, including Byron's venture up the tower. Meantime, Byron worked on the notebook in his lap. "Think 4 copies is enough?" he said to the ambassador. "Plenty, I should think. Thank you." The ambassador took the notebook. "We may have time to run off some mimeograph copies. Very well done." Natalie clasped Byron's hand and pulled it to her lap. She was sitting between him and Sloat. She pressed his fingers, looking seriously at him, her dark eyes half closed. Through her light green dress, he felt the flesh of her thigh on the back of his hand and the ridge of a garter. Sloat repeatedly glanced at the 2 hands clasped in the girl's lap as he calmly smoked, looked out of the window, and chatted with the ambassador about assembling and transporting the refugees. A muscle in Sloat's jaw kept moving under the skin of his white face. In the embassy, all was scurry and noise. The mayor's office had just sent word that the ceasefire was definite now for 1 o'clock. Polish army trucks would take the Americans to the departure point, and each person could bring 1 suitcase. The rush was on. The Americans still living outside the embassy were being summoned by telephone. A smell of burning paper filled the building, and fragments of black ash floated in the corridors. Mark Hartley occupied the cot next to Byron's in the cellar, and Byron found him sitting hunched beside a strapped-up suitcase, head in hands, a dead cigar protruding from his fingers. "Ready to go, Mark?" Hartley uncovered a drawn face, the eyes frightened and bulging. "Horowitz is the name, Byron. Marvin Horowitz." "Nonsense. How will they know that?" Byron pulled from under the cot his old torn bag with the sprung hardware. Hartley shook his head. "I don't know what's wrong with me. I must be crazy. I never once pictured that anything like this would happen. I don't know what I thought. Maybe that Roosevelt would fly us out in army planes, something like that. I've never been so goddamn scared in my life. We're going to the Germans. The Germans!" "Put that in your bag," Byron said,
tossing a worn black book to him as he packed. "And cheer up. You're an American. That's all. An American named Hartley. With a Horowitz face and a Horowitz nose. What's this? The New Testament? What's this for?" Byron took the book, which had a gold cross stamped on the binding, and carefully tore out the flyleaf with his own name written on it. "Make a good Christian of you. Here, put it away. Don't sit around and worry. Go help Rowlandson burn papers." "I wish I had my own Bible or prayer book," Hartley said dully, unstrapping his bag. "I haven't been inside a synagogue since my bar mitzvah. An old smelly Hebrew teacher made me memorize a lot of gibberish. I did it to please my mother, but that was the end. I never went back once. Now I wish I remembered the prayers. Any prayers." He glanced around at the bustling cellar. "So help me, this hole looks to me now like home sweet home. I'd give anything if I could just stay here. Do you think we'll ever play bridge again one day, the four of us? In New York, maybe?"
"Sooner than you think. From your mouth in God's ears. That's what my mother used to say."
The army trucks came snorting and rattling up to the embassy at 11:30. Loose, wobbly, old machines, so caked with mud and rust that their gray paint was scarcely discernible. At their arrival, more than 100 Americans milling inside the fence on the lawn set up a cheer and began singing "California, Here I Come," and such ditties. The Poles of the staff, mostly girl secretaries, were sadly passing out coffee and cake.
"They make me feel ashamed," Natalie said to Byron.
Two of the Polish girls bearing trays had just gone by with fixed, forced smiles and glistening eyes.
"What's the alternative?"
Byron, famished, bit into the coarse gray cake and made a face. It tasted of raw dough and paper ashes.
"There's no alternative."
Byron said, "Mark Hartley is scared stiff of the Germans. How about you?" Natalie's eyes flashed.
"What can they do to me? I have an American passport. They don't know I'm a Jew."
"Well, don't tell them. I mean, don't become all brave or defiant or anything, okay? The idea is just to get the hell out."
"I'm not an imbecile, Byron."
A Polish officer shouted, the gate opened, and the Americans began piling into the trucks. Some people were too old to climb up. Some were trying to take extra luggage. The Polish drivers and officers were urgent and short-tempered, and nobody was in charge. Yelling, complaining, weeping, and fist-waving went on, but most of the people, hungry and uncomfortable though they were, felt so happy at starting out that they continued to sing and laugh. The trucks clanked off in single file. A black Chevrolet with American flags on its fenders brought up the rear, carrying Sloat, his three highest-ranking assistants, and the wives of two of them. Outside the gate, the Polish secretaries stood and waved, tears running down their faces. Byron and Natalie jolted along in a truck, clasping each other's waists. Sloat had offered her a place in the Chevrolet. She had shaken her head without a word. The bombardment was going on as heavily as ever. The distant rumph, rumph, rumph of the artillery, the blasting explosions of bombs from three small Vs of German planes passing slowly in the hazy midday sky, and the popping and stuttering of the Polish anti-aircraft guns. The convoy crawled, stopped, and crawled through the shattered streets, the canyons of yellow-patched structures careening up on sidewalks to avoid holes and tank traps, once backing out of a boulevard blocked by a newly fallen building. At the bridge across the Vistula, truck convoys flying various embassy flags were converging. The bridge was jammed to a standstill with refugee trucks. There were more than 2,000 neutral nations in Warsaw, and every one of them evidently meant to get out. Byron kept glancing at his watch. The traffic started to move again, but so slowly that he feared they might not reach the departure point by 1 o'clock.
German shells kept whistling by, and splashes like geysers boiled up in the river, sometimes showering the bridge and the trucks. The Germans clearly thought it all in the game if they killed 9/10 of the neutrals on the bridge 15 minutes before the ceasefire. The convoys ended in a stupendous pile-up at the schoolhouse with the stone goose. Colonel Rakovsky and the Swedish ambassador stood together in the road, shouting instructions to each truckload of descending passengers and handing out mimeographed instruction sheets. With some pride of authorship, Byron noticed that whoever had traced his sketch on the stencil had faithfully copied it, even to his crude pictures of the three churches. Guns in the woods all around the school were thundering away, but at 1:05, the bombardment began to fade down. At 1:00, the guns fell silent. The loudest noise was the chattering of refugees in many languages along both sides of the road. Byron could hear birds, too, and the strumming of grasshoppers. It struck him that the noise of grasshoppers was the most peaceful sound on earth. A loudspeaker bawled final instructions in one language after another. Groups of neutrals, picking up their suitcases, began to walk down the sloping road. Finally came the English, in a heavy Polish accent.
"Please keep together. Do not make wrong turns. The German command has stated it will accept no responsibility for anybody who is not at the Kantorowicz Church by 3:00. Therefore, the Polish command can accept no such responsibility. It is an easy hour's walk, even for an old person. The enemy will undoubtedly recommence hostilities at 3:00. We will return the heaviest possible fire at the first shot. Please, therefore, hurry. Good luck to you all. Long live America. Long live Poland."
At this, the Americans took up their luggage and walked into no man's land. For 200 or 300 yards, it was no different than the rest of Praha. But then the asphalt road narrowed and trailed off into a dusty, rutted, one-lane cart track. They passed ruined houses. The barnyards had no animals, except for an occasional abandoned chicken wandering and clucking, and some slinking, jumpy cats. The road entered woods where sunlight slanted down in green-yellow bars through the leaves. The leader of the Americans, a tall, gray Episcopalian minister in a black suit and turnaround collar, checked Byron's sketch at each crossroad. This strange, slow walk between two silent enemy armies took a full hour by Byron Henry's watch. As he remembered it later, it was like a stroll in company in peacetime through a fragrant autumnal forest. Many fall flowers, blue and orange and white, dotted the dirt road and the woods. The birds chirped and twittered, and the wonderful song of the grasshoppers filled the air. He also remembered becoming very dry-mouthed and thirsty from tension, so thirsty that his legs felt weak. Two other memories stayed with him. The diplomats' black cars going by, honking the walkers out of the road, with Sloat laughing in the front seat and waving at him and Natalie. And then, near the end of the trek, at the bend of the road where the Kantorowicz church appeared, Mark Hartley, coming up beside him, slipping his hand through his elbow and saying, "My name is Mark Hartley, and oy, I am a good Christian," smiling at Byron, his face dust-caked and terror-stricken. All at once there were the German guns and the German gun crews in the woods. The howitzers were bigger than the Polish artillery pieces, with an appearance of better, newer engineering. Watching the walkers, the soldiers stood quietly at their weapons, in their neat, field-gray and formidable Wehrmacht helmets. Byron peered at the German soldiers with immense curiosity. The helmets gave them a beetling warrior look, but most of them were young, and had the same German faces he had seen in Munich and Frankfurt. Many wore glasses. It was hard to believe that these were the villains who had been pouring flying steel and fire on Warsaw, setting pregnant women aflame, blowing children's legs and hands off, and making a general shambles of a handsome metropolis. They were just young men in soldier suits and stern helmets, standing around in the shady woods amid the pleasant noises of birds and grasshoppers. From the first, the Germans handled the refugees better than the Poles had. A mule-drawn water cart, a large, olive-painted cylinder on wheels, stood by the road near the church, and the soldiers waited with tin cups to herd the thirsty people into a queue. From the water tank, other soldiers guided them toward new, clean, gray trucks, with thick, black, deeply treaded tires, so different from the Poles' dirty, deteriorated machines. Wehrmacht officers, in tailored long military coats and high-peaked caps, were talking amiably, though with marked condescension, to the arriving diplomats near a table by the roadside. As each national group came to the trucks, its ambassador or chargé gave a typed roster to a bespectacled soldier behind the desk. He called off names, and one by one the people entered the vehicles, which, unlike the Polish trucks, had wooden seats. The Poles had not troubled with rosters. There was no bunching up, no disorder. Soldiers stood by with little stools to help up the elderly and to hand the few children to their mothers with a laugh and a playful little swing. At a field ambulance marked with a red cross, medical orderlies gave restoratives. Two soldiers with movie and still cameras roamed the scene, recording all this good treatment of the neutrals. The loading was not quite over when the guns near the church, all at once, shot off a salvo that made the ground shake. Byron's watch read, 3:00.
"Poor Warsaw," Natalie said.
"Don't talk," Mark Hartley said in a low, hoarse voice. "Don't say anything till we're out of this." They sat with Byron on the last bench of a truck, from which they could look out. Natalie said, "Look at Sloat, will you? Taking a cigarette from a German for crying out loud. And laughing. It's just unbelievable. All these German officers with their long coats and pushed-up caps. There they are, just like their pictures."
"Are you afraid?" Byron said.
"Not anymore, now that it's actually happening. I don't know why. It's sort of dreamlike."
"Some dream," Hartley said. "It should only be a dream."
"Jesus Christ, that officer with Sloat is coming here."
Hartley gripped a hand on Byron's knee. The officer, a blonde young man with a good-natured smile, came straight to Byron, speaking with a pleasant accent, slowly and precisely.
"Your chargé tells me that your father is an American naval attaché in Berlin."
"Yes, sir, he is."
"I am a Berliner. My father is in the foreign ministry."
The officer fingered the binoculars around his neck. His manner seemed not very military and rather self-conscious. Byron thought he might be feeling compunction of a sort, and he liked the German better for that.
"I believe I had the pleasure of meeting your parents in August at the Belgian embassy, and of dancing with your mother. What on earth have you been doing in Warsaw?"
"I was sightseeing."
"Well, you saw some unusual sights."
"That I did." The officer laughed and offered his hand to Byron.
"Ernst Baer,"
he said, putting his heels together. "Byron Henry, hi."
"Ah, yes, Henry, I remember the name. Well, you are comfortable? Can I offer you a ride in the staff car?"
"I'm fine. Where are we going?"
"Klovno. It's the nearest working railroad junction, and there you will all transfer to a special train for Königsberg. It's more than a 3-hour trip.
You might enjoy it more in an automobile.
Well, I've been traveling with these folks, you know. I'll stay with them. Thanks a lot.
Byron spoke cordially, though this polite chit-chat with a German felt exceedingly strange after all his anger at them.
Sloat said to Natalie, "We can still make room for you in the Chevy. That wooden slat's going to get kind of hard."
She shook her head, looking darkly at the German.
"Give my best to your mother," said the officer,
with a casual glance at the girl and back to Byron.
"She was really charming to me."
"I sure will."
Several guns fired in succession nearby, drowning out something the officer said. He grimaced and smiled.
"How are things in Warsaw now? Very distressing?"
"Well, they seem to be hanging on pretty well."
Half addressing Natalie as well as Byron, Bayer said,
"A bad business. The Polish government was completely irresponsible, running off into Romania and leaving the country without leadership. Warsaw should have been declared an open city 2 weeks ago. This destruction is pointless. It will cost a lot to repair. The mayor is very brave, and there's a lot of admiration here for him, but," he shrugged, "what is there to do but finish it off? This will be over in a day or two."
"It may take longer than that," Byron said.
"You think so?"
Bayer's pleasant smile faded. He bowed slightly and walked off, toying with the glasses. Sloat shook his head at Byron and followed the officer.
"Why the hell did you get him mad?" Hartley whispered.
"Oh, Christ, blaming the Polish government for the siege."
"He meant it," Natalie said in a wondering tone. "The man was absolutely sincere."
With some shouting in German, snorting of motors, honking of horns, waving by the soldiers, the convoy departed from Kantorovich, a hamlet of half a dozen wooden houses around the church, intact but abandoned. Since leaving the schoolhouse, the refugees had not seen a living Pole, nor a dead one. The trucks wound along one-lane dirt roads, passing burned-out barns, blown-apart houses, overturned windmills, broken churches, schoolhouses without windows or roofs, and much torn-up, shell-plowed ground and charred tree stumps. Still, the scene was not at all like battlegrounds in movies and books of the last war. Gray wastes of barren, dead muck, tangles of barbed wire, dark, zigzagging trenches. These fields and woods were green. Crops were still standing. Only the inhabitants were eerily absent. It was almost as though H.G. Wells's invaders from Mars had passed through in their perambulating metal tripods, atomizing or eating the people, and leaving only slight trails of their transit. The first Poles who came in sight, far behind the German lines, were an old man and his wife, working in a field in late sunshine. They leaned on their implements and solemnly watched the trucks go by. As the trucks traveled farther from Warsaw, more peasants began to appear, going about their field work or repairing damaged houses, either ignoring the trucks or watching their passage with blank faces. Nearly all were old people or children. In this back country, Byron saw no young men, and only two or three kerchiefed, skirted figures that, from their slimness and supple movements, might have been girls. Yet more striking, he saw not one horse. The horse and the vehicles it pulled were the trademark, the very life, of rural Poland. On the way from Krakow to Warsaw, there had been thousands of horses, clogging the roads, working the fields, carrying soldiers, dragging heavy loads in the cities. Behind the German lines, this animal seemed extinct. The ride was too bumpy for conversation, and the refugees were still tired, and perhaps frightened by the deepening awareness of being in the hands of the Germans. Hardly a word was spoken in the first hour or so.
They came out on a tarred road, narrow and primitive enough, but by comparison with the cart tracks of the back country, a glassy highway. The convoy stopped at a knoll of smooth green lawns and flower gardens topped by a brick-walled convent, and the word passed for women passengers to dismount and refresh themselves. The ladies happily went off, the men scattered among the trees or urinated by the roadside, and when the convoy rolled again, everybody was much more cheerful. Talk sprang up. Natalie brought back gossip from the ladies' room. All the neutrals, she said, would be offered a choice of flying to Stockholm, or else of taking German trains to Berlin, and thence going out via Belgium, Holland, or Switzerland. "You know," the girl said, with a mild glint in her eye, "I'd sort of like to see Berlin myself."
"Are you crazy?" said Hartley. "Are you absolutely crazy? You must be kidding. You go to Stockholm, baby, and you just pray they let you go to Stockholm. This girl has a screw loose," Hartley said to Byron.
Byron said, "Beryl's message to AJ goes for you, too. Lech lecha."
"Lech lecha,"
she smiled. Byron had told her about this. "Get out, huh? Well, maybe."
"In the name of God," Hartley muttered, "stop with the Hebrew."
The ride stretched out to 4 and 5 hours of grinding through farmland and forests. All traces of war faded from the landscape. Houses, churches, whole towns were untouched. The inhabitants looked and acted as they had in peacetime, countryside. There were few young people, no horses, and very little cattle and poultry. In the towns, a red swastika flag flew over the main square, either on a flagpole or from the town hall, and German soldiers stood sentry or patrolled on foot or on motorcycles. But the conquered land was at peace. The absence of livestock and young folks gave it a dead look. The peasants seemed somewhat more dour and sullen, perhaps, but life was going on exactly as before, except that the Germans were in charge. The sun sank behind the distant flat horizon in a brief glow of pale orange. The trucks rolled on into the night. The passengers quieted. Natalie Jastrow put her head on Byron's shoulder and took his hand in hers. They both dozed. Commands shouted in German woke them. Lights blazed. They were in a square before a wide railroad station, and people were streaming down out of the lined-up trucks. The lower half-door of their truck was still closed, but two helmeted Germans came along and opened it with a clank.
"Bitte raus, alle im Wartesaal."
Their manner was brisk, not hostile, and they stood by to help down the women and old men. It was a cool, moonlit night, and Byron was glad to see darkness and stars overhead once more, instead of a smoke pall and a fiery glow. The refugees gathered in a confused mass in the waiting room, still blinking at the light. Double doors opened at one end of the room, and soldiers shouting in German shepherded them through, bearing along Byron and Natalie. Byron carried their suitcases, and Hartley clung like a child to his elbow. They entered a dining hall full of long plank tables on trestles, laden with food. It was the most dazzling banquet that Byron had seen in his life. Or so it seemed in the first thunderstruck seconds, famished as he was after the long ride and the 3 weeks of wretched food in besieged Warsaw. There were platters of smoking sausages and sauerkraut. There were many whole pink hams. There were mounds of boiled potatoes, piles of fried chicken, stacked loaves of fresh bread, pitchers of beer, immense whole yellow and orange cheeses. But it seemed a mockery, a cruel Nazi trick, a Barmecide feast, because the soldiers herded the neutrals along the walls, away from the tables. There they stood,
hundreds of them, staring at the distant food, and in the space between stood a few alert German soldiers with lowered Tommy guns. A voice spoke over a loudspeaker in clear conversational German.
"Welcome. The German people are your hosts. We welcome the citizens of the neutral countries in peace and friendship. The German people seek peace with all nations. Relations with Poland have now been normalized. The treacherous Schmiegelritz regime, having met its just punishment, has ceased to exist. A new Poland will rise from its ashes, cleaned up and law-abiding, where everybody will work hard and irresponsible politicians will no longer provoke disastrous foreign adventures. The Führer can now seriously pursue a peaceful settlement of all outstanding questions with Great Britain and France, and afterward Europe will enter on a new order of unparalleled mutual prosperity. Now we ask you to sit down and eat. Hearty appetite."
A dozen smiling blonde girls in white waitress uniforms made their entrance, almost like a theater chorus, carrying jugs of coffee and stacks of plates. The soldiers smiled and walked out of the space in front of the tables, making inviting, hospitable motions with their lowered guns. There was an awkward, shocked moment. First one and then another refugee hesitantly stepped out of ranks to cross the space. Others followed them. A few sat on the low benches reaching for food, and a noisy break and rush began. Like the rest, Byron, Natalie, and Hartley dived for places and gorged themselves on the richest, sweetest, most satisfying meal of their lives. Almost the best of it was the coffee. Ersatz, though it was. Hot. All they wanted, poured again and again by willing, cheery, buxom girls. Over the loudspeaker, while they stuffed, came a cascade of brass band music, Strauss waltzes, marches, and jolly drinking songs. Many of the neutrals began singing, and even the watching soldiers joined in.
Du, du, liegst mir im Herzen, du, du, liegst mir im Sinn.
Byron himself, relaxed by the beer and carried away by the ecstasy of a full belly, the lift of the music, and the outburst of relieved high spirits all around him, swung his stein and sang.
Du, du, machst mir viel Schmerzen, weiß nicht wie gut ich dir bin. Ja, 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 weiß nicht wie gut ich dir bin.
And Mark Hartley sang right along too, though his eyes never ceased rolling at the German soldiers. Natalie, silent, regarded them both with a satirical, motherly look. Returning to the waiting room, stuffed and dizzy after this incredible, this visionary feast, they saw crudely lettered placards around the brown tile walls. Belgian, Bulgarian, Canada, Niederlande. They went and stood under the Vereinigte Staaten sign. Laughing, chattering, the refugees sorted themselves out, gay as though returning from a picnic. Men in black uniforms entered the waiting room. Conversation died among the Americans, and the cheery noise faded throughout the station. Sloat said soberly, "Listen, please, everybody. Those are the SS. I'll do any talking to them that has to be done." The men in black fanned out, one to each group of neutrals. The one who headed for the Americans did not appear sinister. Except for the operatic black costume, with its silver double lightning flash insignia, he looked like an American himself. Perhaps a young insurance salesman one might sit next to on a train or plane. He carried a black leather portfolio. Sloat walked out to meet him. "I'm Leslie Sloat, First Secretary of the United States Embassy and Acting Chargé d'Affaires."
The SS man bowed, heels together, both hands on the case.
"You have a gentleman named Byron Henry in your party."
His English was smooth. "This is Byron Henry," Sloat said. Byron took a step forward.
"Your father represents the American Navy in Berlin?"
Byron nodded.
"This message is forwarded to you via the foreign ministry."
Byron put the yellow envelope in his breast pocket.
"You may read it now, of course."
"Thanks, I'll look at it later." The SS man turned to Sloat.
"I am to collect the American passports."
His tone was brisk and cool, his blue eyes distant, almost unfocused on the foreign serviceman.
"Let me have them, please."
Sloat was very pale.
"I'm reluctant to surrender them for obvious reasons." "I assure you it is quite routine. They are to be processed on the train. They will be returned to you before you arrive in Königsberg."
"Very well." At a motion from Sloat, an assistant gave him a thick red portfolio, which he handed to the man in black.
"Thank you. Now your roster, please."
The assistant held out three clipped sheets. The SS man glanced through them and then looked around.
"No Negroes in your party, I see. How many Jews?"
Sloat took a moment to reply. "I'm sorry, but in our passports we make no record of religious affiliation."
"But you do have Jews?"
The man spoke offhandedly, as though discussing doctors or carpenters. "Even if there were Jews in the party, I would have to decline to answer. The policy of my country on religious groups is one of absolute equality of treatment."
"But nobody is suggesting that there will be inequality of treatment. Who are these Jews, please?"
Sloat looked silently at him, touching his tongue to his lips. The SS officer said,
"You have mentioned your government's policy. We will respect it. The policy of my government is simply to maintain separate records where Jews are concerned. Nothing else is involved."
Byron, a couple of paces forward from the group, wanted to see how Natalie and Hartley were behaving, but he knew it would be disastrous to glance at them. Sloat did look around at the whole party in a glance of caution, appeal, and great nervousness, but he produced a calm, professional tone when he spoke. "I'm sorry. I just don't know if anybody here is Jewish. I'm not personally interested, I haven't asked, and I don't have the information."
"My instructions are to separate out the Jews," said the officer, "and I must now do that."
He turned to the Americans and said,
"Form a double line alphabetically, please."
Nobody moved. They all looked to Sloat. The SS man turned to him.
"Your party is in the custody of the Wehrmacht, in a combat zone under strict martial law. I call this to your attention."
Sloat glanced out toward the waiting room, his face harried. In front of several parties, the Swiss, the Romanian, the Hungarian, the Dutch, a few miserable Jews already stood separated, heads bowed, with their suitcases.
"Look here. For your purposes, you can assume we're all Jews."
His voice was starting to shake. "What next?"
Byron heard a shrill woman's voice behind him.
"Now, just a minute. What on earth do you mean by that, Mr. Sloat? I'm certainly not a Jew, and I won't be classified or treated as one."
Sloat turned and said angrily,
"I mean that we all must be treated alike, Mrs. Young, that's all. Please, cooperate as I asked."
"Nobody's putting me down for a Jew," said a man's voice from a different direction. "I'm just not buying that either, Leslie. Sorry."
Byron recognized both voices. He turned around as the SS officer addressed the woman.
"Yes, madam, who are you, please?"
"Clara Young of Chicago, Illinois, and I'm not Jewish. You can be darn sure of that."
She was a dried-out little woman of 60 or so, a bookkeeper in the American movie distributor's office in Warsaw. She giggled, glancing here and there.
"Would you be kind enough to point out the Jews in your party, madam?"
"Oh, no, thank you, mister. That's your business, not mine." Byron expected that. He was more worried by the man, a retired army officer named Tom Stanley, who had been selling heavy machinery to the Polish government. Stanley was given to saying that Hitler was a great man and that the Jews had brought all their trouble on themselves. The SS man asked for Stanley's name and then said to him, in a cordial man-to-man way,
"Who are the Jews here, please? Your party can't leave until I know." "You seem to understand this matter better than your chargé."
Stanley, an old turkey cock of a man with hanging jowls, a wattled throat, and a brush of gray hair, grew quite red and cleared his throat several times, thrusting his hands into the pockets of his loud green and brown sports jacket. All the Americans were staring at him.
"Well, I'll tell you, friend, I'd like to cooperate, but so far as I know, there aren't any. Not in this party."
The SS officer shrugged, ran his eyes over the group, and stopped at Mark Hartley. He flicked two fingers forward.
"You, yes, you, the one with the blue bow tie, step this way."
Again he flicked the fingers.
"Stay where you are," Sloat said to Hartley, then to the officer.
"I would like to have your name and rank. I protest this procedure, and I warn you that this incident will result in a written protest from my government if it continues." The SS officer gestured around the waiting room and said in a reasonable tone,
"The officials of all the other governments are cooperating. You see for yourself. This is nothing to protest. This is a simple matter of conforming to local regulations. What is your name, you there?"
"Mark Hartley."
The voice was steady.